Good evening, everyone. Glad you could all come out tonight to hear about the Great Awakening, a mighty revival. And you know, one of the things I was thinking about as I was preparing to, as reading this morning in Exodus, I think it was in chapter 34, where Moses was asking God to see his glory. And I thought, wow, look at all the things that Moses had already seen God do by that time. You know, God had already sent the plagues, he'd split the Red Sea, they'd gone through it, he'd been on Mount Sinai already, you know, and yet Moses still said, Lord, I want to see your glory. And you know, that's part of what revival is about. It's about God manifesting himself, showing his presence in a special way, you know, for his people. And so that's really the purpose of us coming together to sort of talk about revivals, because we want to see it happen. We want to see God's presence. We want to see God's glory here. And Jonathan Edwards, one of the people I'm going to be talking about a good deal tonight, wrote one time in his writings about revival, he said, quote, "There is no one thing that I know of that God has made such a means of promoting his work amongst us as the news of others' conversion. In the awakening of sinners and engaging them earnestly to seek the same blessing, and in the quickening of the saints," or bringing life to the saints. So when we hear about these things, hopefully this will stir us up to encourage us to seek God's favor, God's presence among us, seek conversion, and to seek to bring conversion to others. Now, it's important to understand that in the colonial context in the Americas, where we're going to be talking about tonight, and I have a map up there showing you what the colonies looked like then and sort of give you a religious breakdown there of what it looked like at the time. There was a variety of religious expressions, Protestantism primarily, although there were a few Catholic churches, especially in Maryland here. But in the north, you had mainly congregational churches that had come from the Puritan heritage that I'm sure you're all aware of. The Puritans settled up in Massachusetts Bay Colony and then spread out to Connecticut and areas. There was some Baptists up in the Rhode Island area there. Good Presbyterians, Lutherans in this middle colonies, and also Quakers in Pennsylvania too, to some degree. But Anglican establishment was pretty well established here in the southern colonies here, but also had a pretty strong showing in some of the other colonies as well. Puritanism in New England had a great stress on conversion and the need for a conversion experience. But however, by the middle of the 1600s, and especially by the early 1700s, a lot of that zeal had waned, and many preachers by the early 1700s were complaining about the lack of religious zeal in a lot of the churches at the time. On the other hand, there also were pastors themselves who were part of the problem, who themselves were not converted, and we're going to see how this gets played out too during the time of the Great Awakenings. The Great Awakening itself was going to be a revival that was going to break out in 1739 on into the early 1740s, but there were some significant stirrings before 1740 that we want to talk about. And one of the most important of these was in the congregation of Jonathan Edwards. And so I'm going to say a good bit about Edwards. Here's an engraving of him at the time. He was in Northampton, Massachusetts, where he was a pastor. To give you a little background on him, he was really a brilliant man. By age 13, he was fluently reading Greek, Hebrew, and Latin. He graduated from Yale University at age 17, head of his class, and he also had a conversion experience at age 17. And this was going to, of course, have a profound impact on him religiously. He became an assistant pastor to his grandfather in 1726 after serving in a few other places before then. This was in Northampton, Massachusetts. And then he became the head pastor there in 1729 when his grandfather died. His grandfather had been something of a preacher of revival and conversions, and he had experienced five separate awakenings that were local in scope. They didn't spread out much beyond his own congregation, and they primarily affected the young people of his congregation. What would happen was there'd be these revivals. People would get this excitement, intensity of excitement about the Lord, and there'd be a lot of conversions among the young people. And then, of course, once they're converted, then that would sort of die down for a little while. And then another generation, as young people are growing up and a new generation's coming up, then there would be another wave of revivals that would break out. He had five different times in his ministry that this took place over many years. And so Jonathan Edwards was in that particular context there. But Jonathan Edwards was very grieved too about some of the what he saw as the status of Christianity in his day. Edwards wrote at one point, and this actually, he wrote this actually after some of the revivals had already broken out and such, so it is all the more poignant. He said, quote, "It is now a very dark time with respect to the interests of religion." You know, we look around and we think, bah, it's a pretty dark time, you know, around here. Well, you know, that's what they were experiencing before these revivals, and that's why we need revival. It's during these dark times. But, you know, there are times such as Edwards saw that things were very bleak. Things were did seem very dark. And today when we see things dark, it shouldn't discourage us to think that we can't see revival. That's the very time when God does often intervene with us. What happened in this particular case, Edwards was very circumspect and very much pushing for conversions and preaching the pure gospel. And he was making a little bit of headway in the first several years of his ministry. He said, actually, the first few years after his grandfather died, he said things sort of got worse for a few years. But then by 1733, he said he saw a little bit of glimmerings of some stirrings in some of the young people, them becoming a little bit more sober. But then in 1734, a couple of events took place that were going to have a pretty profound impact on that community. And this was two deaths that took place that year. There was one young man who suddenly died. And this death, together with Edwards speaking about it, his messages that he gave about it and such, did have a pretty profound impact on the young people of that community, realizing, wow, you know, we don't have any guarantee of our tomorrow. You know, this guy just suddenly drops dead. And then there was a second death that took place. And in the second case, it was a young woman who was deathly ill for a while before she died. And long before she passed away, she herself had a conversion experience and began telling all the young people that they needed to also trust in Christ. And this was going to have a big impact on sort of sobering up the community, and especially the young people there. And so after this happened, Jonathan Edwards began encouraging the young people to gather together for religious meetings. And they did. They began gathering together in small groups in people's homes and such, and began talking about the things of God. And apparently the older people went ahead and followed suit there. And Jonathan Edwards himself began following this up by preaching about conversion. And specifically, one of his key things that he was going to stress was the Reformation doctrine of justification by faith. We talked a couple of times before when we were talking about the Reformation period, about how that was one of the key doctrines that brought on the Reformation and set off a wave of revival going on throughout Europe in the 16th century. And then when we talked last time about the Methodist revivals in Britain, we also noted that one of the main doctrines being taught was justification by faith. Well, guess what? Again, once again, one of the main doctrines that's going to be a center of the revivals as they break out here was justification by faith. And so Edwards began stressing that, and then there was a breakthrough that took place in December 1734. And here's how Edwards described that particular breakthrough. Edwards said, quote, "And then it was, in the latter part of December 1734, that the Spirit of God began extraordinarily to set in and wonderfully to work amongst us. And there were, very suddenly, one after another, five or six persons who were to all appearance savingly converted, and some of them wrought upon in a very remarkable manner." And then he said, "The news of it," the conversions, "the news of it seemed to be almost like a flash of lightning upon the hearts of young people all over the town and upon many others." So once this started, it sort of snowballed. Once it started, it just set off a chain reaction. People began getting excited about the things of God. They started themselves grappling with their need for conversion, especially, again, it started mainly among the young people, but then it was going to spread out. And one of the things that, in fact,
Edwards was going to say that was different about this particular revival in 1734 to 35 from his grandfather's times of awakenings was that his grandfather's had been pretty much confined to the young people, whereas he said this one, there were a lot of older people converted too who had never had conversion experiences before. And in fact, as the people began grappling with this and dealing with this, just about everyone in the community began talking about the things of God. They started talking about spiritual things just all over the community. Edward said that people began eagerly reading their Bibles and praying. There were religious meetings in private homes that were becoming crowded, and everyone was just coming together to talk about the things of God. And Edwards said this about the way that this changed and transformed his community. He said, quote, "There was scarcely a single person in the town, either old or young, that was left unconcerned about the great things of the eternal world. Those that were wont to be the vainest and loosest, and those who had been the most disposed to think and speak slightly of vital and experimental religion, were now generally subject to great awakenings." I like that he uses that. He actually uses this word here about this thing, great awakenings, although that term great awakening itself to refer to these revivals hadn't yet come into being, of course. And then he went on to say, "And the work of conversion was carried on in a most astonishing manner and increased more and more. Souls did, as it were, come by flocks to Jesus Christ. This work of God, as it was carried on, and the number of true saints multiplied, soon made a glorious alteration in the town, so that in the spring and summer following, that is 1735, the town seemed to be full of the presence of God. It was never so full of love, nor so full of joy, and yet so full of distress as it was then." It's full of the presence of God. And by the way, that last part about full of the distress was distress over people who had not yet been converted. The stress over their sins was what he was talking about. The people who weren't converted were getting under conviction. They were coming to realize, wow, I need this too. And if they hadn't come to that experience themselves. So those that had already experienced a conversion were filled with joy, and those who hadn't were filled with distress and seeking after conversion there. So, you know, he says flocks were coming. Well, what was he talking about here? Well, the town he was in was not really a huge town by our thinking of it. It's about 200 families actually in the town itself. I think I have actually a shot here showing you. Here's what Northampton, Massachusetts looks like. There's the church that Edwards was at, and then you see some of the houses sprinkled around. There were only about 200 families in that town. But in 6 months, Edwards estimates that 300 people were converted in Northampton at that time. So this is a pretty powerful event. And, you know, again, everyone's just getting excited about the things of God there. And not only that, but the revival began spreading to neighboring towns as well. People would come and visit their town and be, you know, very shocked at what they found and very different from what they were experiencing in their own town. They would take back news of what was happening in Northampton, and that would touch off revivals in some of the surrounding towns. Not only that, but Edwards then wrote a letter to a pastor in Boston, and it was about an 8-page letter describing what had taken place in his town. And this pastor in Boston sent that letter to some pastors he knew in England, one of which was Isaac Watts, the famous hymn writer. We'll be singing a hymn of his a little bit later. And they were so impressed by it that one of them read it from his pulpit in London and didn't really touch off a revival initially, but it stirred interest in revival and started to have an impact. And so the pastor in Boston wrote back to Edwards and said, "Hey, why don't you write up a longer account of what was taking place in there?" And so in late 1736, Edwards wrote up an account of the revivals. I like the title of this thing. They used long titles back then, these things. The title of this piece is called "A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God in the Conversion of Many Hundred Souls in Northampton and the Surrounding Towns and Villages in the County of Hampshire in the Province of Massachusetts Bay in New England." Usually people just call that the faithful narrative. That's usually what the title of people give it for short. But The faithful narrative was going to be published in England originally, in London, in 1735, because it got sent to those same pastors who were interested in Edward's work and revival. And it was going to help stimulate revival there with Watts and another guy named Guise and others there as they began publicizing about what was going on in Northampton. Wesley read the faithful narrative. Whitfield got a hold of it. Other people, other preachers of revival in England were going to get a hold of it. And so it actually had an impact. I mentioned it briefly last time when we talked about the Methodist revivals in Britain. So this was going to be a pretty remarkable stimulus also. And that's one of the reasons why Edward said it's so important for us to talk about these things of revival, because then it's going to stir it up elsewhere. Once people hear about it going on somewhere, they think, wow, why aren't we having this? You know, we need this too. And so they begin praying, you know, God, please bring us a revival here. We see they're having it. Why aren't we having it? And so they start praying and seeking God for it. And then they start expecting it, too, to happen. You know, it's very easy. We just sort of go through our day-to-day life, and we just see the sort of church life, quote, normal church life, you know, as it is going along. And we just sort of get used to that. And, you know, sometimes we don't expect more than that. But God wants us to expect more. You know, just like I talked at the outset about Moses. You know, Moses was saying, Lord, I want more, you know, than what I've got so far. You know, no matter how much we already have, we still need more. And so by Jonathan Edwards publicizing this, it really did get people's expectation up, and they built their faith, you know, that God can come and intervene, and we can see God do great and mighty things here. Now, Edwards later on was going to preach one of the most famous sermons, in Enfield, Connecticut in 1741. Probably you've heard of it, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And Edwards preached a lot of sermons about a lot of different topics, and so this even though there is a sense in which this is iconic, we don't want to get the idea that he was always preaching, you know, hellfire and damnation. But yes, he did. He did preach hellfire and damnation here in Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and he talked about God's anger with sin, something that we don't hear a whole lot about in much of our society today. How we need that, and he did talk about their danger of being sent to hell. That was a fairly prominent feature of their preaching, the sin and the consequences of sin. But once they brought them to that, then they would also preach justification by faith and God's love for his people, that God doesn't want you to go there, you know, that he wants to bring salvation to you. One of the interesting things about this particular sermon, though, about sinners in the hands of an angry God, is that unlike Whitfield, whom we talked about last time and whom I'm going to talk more about today because he came to the colonies and was one of the main drivers in the Great Awakening, Edwards was not a really dynamic orator in the same sense that Whitfield was. Whitfield was an incredibly dynamic, dramatic kind of orator who, in fact, it says that when Whitfield preached, he almost always cried in his sermons. He must always, you know, he had incredible power and push and emotional intensity to his sermons. Edward was not like that at all. Edwards was more didactic, very rational in his approach. When I say rational, that's not the right word, though, because, I mean, he did want to cut to people's hearts, and their emotions, not just to their head knowledge. But the way he has been described is almost monotone. I mean, he basically got up and read his sermon, you know, there. Whitfield preached very extemporaneously usually. Edwards usually wrote out his sermons, this is very typical for the time. He'd write out the entire sermon and he'd read it to the people. And again, some people said that it was almost in a monotone. But interestingly, when he preached that particular sermon, and he preached it actually once in his own congregation before he preached in Connecticut, but when he preached in Enfield, Connecticut, this particular congregation had not really experienced a revival yet. But he was filling the pulpit that Sunday for the pastor. I think the pastor was away or something. I forgot what exactly the situation was. But anyway, he was a guest preacher there, and he preached that sermon, and it had an electrifying impact on the audience. Again, even though it was not, you know, given. But if you look at the content of it, and you could look at it yourself, just go online and, you know, Google Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You'll find it. You can find the whole sermon online and such. It's incredible how he was able to use these images and get people to understand their need for a Savior, and then bring people to understand that, you know, you can come to Christ. In fact, it's said that he was not even able to finish the sermon because there was so much chaos going on and so much commotion created as people were just crying out and you know, just desperate for, you know, salvation. And so it created an incredible stir in the congregation, so much so that he had to sort of stop his sermon there as people are wanting salvation and God's dealing with the hearts of the people there. Edwards was going to go on to become one of America's greatest theologians, and many people see him as, today, many people regard him as the greatest theologian that America has ever produced. But interestingly, even after all of this went on, and he led these revivals, in 1750, he was actually dismissed from his congregation. He was kicked out of his pastoral office because he tried to introduce a policy that a lot of other churches already were doing in his area. In fact, his father was a pastor too. His father's congregation practiced this, which was closed communion. Communion only for those that were members that had identified a conversion experience. His grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, before him in Northampton, had open communion, had allowed anyone to come who was at least living a moral life or whatever. If you were completely living in immorality, perhaps you wouldn't. But if you're living in a moral life and such, you could take communion. So he was kicked out of his congregation. Then he went to work as a missionary among some Indians for a while, American Indians in Massachusetts. And then in 1758, he became the third president of what was that at that time called the College of New Jersey, which is today Princeton University. However, he died 3 months after assuming that office from a vaccination gone bad. But in any case, Edward was one, and he was a pivotal figure in the very early phases of this, but he was not the only figure. God was raising up other men simultaneously, and some of them were even preaching and doing a lot of things even before Edwards was there. For example, William and his son Gilbert Tennant were preaching a message of conversion among Presbyterians. Edwards was Congregationalist in Massachusetts. These were Presbyterians in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, respectively. And William Tennant set up what was called the Log College, or the Log Cabin College, sometimes it's called, which was a training ground for preachers. So this was a seminary, essentially, back in the 1720s. This was the seminary. In fact, his son was trained up there and went out to be a preacher, Presbyterian minister in New Jersey. And his son, Gilbert, was going to, in fact, become even more influential than he by becoming an itinerant minister at times, too. In fact, George Whitfield was going to encourage Gilbert Tennant to go out and itinerate at the time. But in 1735, at the same time that Edwards was leading his revivals, Gilbert was preaching very similar kinds of messages. One of them was entitled this, "A Solemn Warning to the Secure World from the God of Terrible Majesty." That was one of his sermons, "The Secure World." In other words, you're all thinking you're okay, but, you know, maybe you're not. So he was really trying to get to the heart of these people. In fact, Gilbert Tennant was going to preach what some think was probably the most famous sermon of the Great Awakening. In 1740, he preached a sermon called "The Danger of an Unconverted Ministry." And in that sermon, which was published, and so was publicized throughout the colonies there, his basic message was to defend people being able to go to listen to itinerant ministers or even ministers from other parishes or towns or whatever around them rather than having to go to the one in their own town if that particular person was unconverted. If the pastor in your town's unconverted, he said, you should go to another town to hear someone who is converted, who can really preach the true gospel. You should be able to listen to itinerant minister coming through. Because what was happening at that time was that a lot of pastors were saying, no, this is my territory. You know, they had this idea of the parish being my territory, and that's pretty much how it worked. So we're in this town, you know, you must go to my church. You can't go to another church or anything like that. And so he was basically challenging that. But part of the challenge, of course, is in the title of this thing is the danger of an unconverted ministry. So he's essentially accusing a lot of ministers of not being converted. So you can imagine this didn't go along very well with some of those in the more established churches and such. The text of his sermon, by the way, was Mark 6:34, and Jesus, when he came out, saw much people and was moved with compassion towards them because they were as sheep, not having a shepherd. You know, so that's the text he was preaching on there. Gilbert Tennant had a very powerful influence, and I came across, just this afternoon as I was preparing this stuff, I came across this really interesting poem, and I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I'm going to read a good bit of it here, about Gilbert Tennant. This is a poem that was written about Gilbert Tennant in the 1740s. After he had preached, this is published in 1741. And let me just read this. I think this really gives you a glimpse at what their message was and what they were trying to do. Not just Tennant, but also Edwards and Whitfield and all of the preachers in the Great Awakening and what they were doing. So here it goes. It says, "We bless the man sent by the Spirit of grace to turn poor sinners into wisdom's ways, to plow the barren and break the fallow ground, dissect the heart and show the mortal wound. There's few like him that ever we have seen since lovely Whitfield. Oh, how sharp and keen. He wields God's law, the Holy Spirit's sword, and wound the heart at almost every word. A Boanerges sometimes he'll appear, and then a sweet and lovely comforter. So skillful surgeons first rip up the wound, then ply their medicines till the patient's sound. The false professors by him tried and cast, he shows the doom they're sure to have at last. The formalist he searches to the root, and shows they bring forth naught but rotten fruit. The hypocrite he doth anatomize, shows they're made up of sordid fallacies. When he sounds forth the thunders of the law, he strikes the soul with trembling and with awe. And when the gospel charms he doth display, on wings of faith, believing souls away, they mount, they fly unto the blessed abode, where Jesus reigns, the great incarnate God. While he sets forth the great Redeemer's charms, they soar aloft into his blessed arms." Okay, I could go on here, but I think you sort of get the idea here. There is a strong emphasis in here on preaching against sin and getting people to come under the conviction of sin, but then, you know, then they apply the medicine, as he says here. Then they come along and bring the healing message of Jesus, who is the one that can save them from those sins and the only hope that they have there. So, actually, I didn't read the part where they actually named Tennant. Just down here a little ways, it says, "While hell without a covering they court, I to the dear Redeemer will resort. I hear the call the lovely Tennant brings, because I know it's from the King of Kings." Okay, so there they actually named Tennant in this poem. So, again, the poem keeps going on. There's more to it than this. If you want to read it later, I can show it to you. It's really interesting poem about the way that they see Gilbert Tennant and his powerful ministry. But Edwards and Tennant weren't the only ones either. Whitfield was actually perhaps even more powerful in spreading the Great Awakening and certainly in bringing it to a wider geographic area, because Whitfield was going to be called by some people the Great Itinerant. And here's Whitfield preaching in Philadelphia there, which was one of his key bases, especially up in the north. Now, the revival, what's generally referred to as the Great Awakening, many historians claim that that was a period from 1739 to the early 1940s. But Whitfield actually came to the colonies a little bit before that time. He originally came in 1738 to Georgia, where John Wesley had gone earlier. If you were here last time, talked about Wesley and how he'd gone to Georgia for a time. Well, Whitfield also went to Georgia after Wesley had left. And he was sort of, replacing Wesley to some degree there. And while he only spent 3 months, however, in Georgia before going back to England. But while he was there, one of the things that he did is he promised to build an orphanage in Georgia. And this orphanage was going to be something that remained on Whitfield's heart throughout the rest of his ministry. In fact, when he went back to England, and also when he preached in a lot of the other of the American colonies, he very often would try to raise money for the orphanage there. And he was very persuasive in his money raising. In fact, Benjamin Franklin, who was a good friend of Whitfield, and I'll talk about Franklin just a little bit. Franklin said one time when Whitfield was preaching that he was determined he was not going to give any money to Whitfield's orphanage because he had tried to convince Whitfield that he should establish an orphanage in Philadelphia rather than in Georgia. So it's not that he had anything against Whitfield personally, but he thought, you know, why should we have this one in Georgia there? Why should we raise money for that? So he thought, I'm not going to give any money at all. So he said, while Whitfield was preaching and calling the people to give money to his church in, or his orphanage rather, he said he finally softened up a little bit and decided, okay, I'll give the copper coins in my pocket. You know, I'll give those to, when the offering comes around. He said as Whitfield went on, he became more and more ashamed and finally said, okay, I guess I'll give the four silver dollars I've got in my pocket too. I'll give those to the thing. By the time he said the offering came around, he emptied the gold, silver, and everything into the offering. It was there. But this was something that was really on Whitfield's heart. He saw this as a work of compassion for the people, and he was focused on trying to do charitable works as well as trying to convert people in the meetings that he was holding. But the main point was conversion. The main point was he was trying to bring people to conversion in these meetings as he was going about. And he returned back to the colonies in late 1739. He arrived in Philadelphia and began a preaching tour there. The people in the American colonies by 1739 already knew about Whitfield because he had become a dynamic preacher in England. We talked about this again last time. Even before he'd gone to Georgia, he'd been drawing thousands of people preaching in London and in other parts of England. And so people had already caught wind of what was going on and they knew about Whitfield. So when he arrived there, it was easy to publicize his meetings. There was already a buzz that was already happening. And Whitfield also was keen to write up his journals about different things that had gone on and publish those, and those also spread the word about what was going on. And so there were a lot of people that were finding out about what Whitfield was doing, and it created a lot of interest in him. So when he came, he began to draw fairly large crowds fairly quickly there. His messages that he was preaching throughout the colonies almost always centered on the need for conversion, justification by faith, and trying to bring people to a point of decision to follow the Lord and to have a conversion. He was in Philadelphia in part of 1740, and at one point in Philadelphia, he addressed a crowd that was probably about 20,000 people strong. This was at a time when the population of Philadelphia was 13,000, and he drew 20,000 people to listen to him preach, which means there were not only just about everyone in Philadelphia was there, but people from the surrounding regions came around to hear him preach. Benjamin Franklin, who became a friend of Whitfield's, was a little skeptical about the reports he'd heard in England about how many people had heard Whitfield preach. And so he decided to test it out and to figure out how many people could actually hear Whitfield preach. So he actually walked off till he could no longer hear Whitfield preaching, measured the distance, thought about the distance, figured out how many people could be packed into that amount of space, and figured out that Whitfield could have easily preached to 30,000 people at a time based on his projection of his voice out to the people. So when we're talking about these 20,000 people, these 20,000 people all heard him. You know, these are people that actually heard what he was preaching at the time when he was preaching, which seems pretty remarkable when you think about it now. Franklin was also noted Whitfield's incredible influence that he had through his oratory. Again, I told you, Whitfield was an incredible orator, and he had an incredible impact on people's emotions. Franklin described Whitfield's influence this way. He said, quote, "It was a matter of speculation to me, who was one of the number," meaning of the number, you know, he was one of them that was hearing the sermon, "It was a matter of speculation to me, who was one of the number, to observe the extraordinary influence of his oratory on his hearers, and how much they admired and respected him, notwithstanding his common abuse of them, by assuring them that they were naturally half-beasts and half-devils. It was wonderful to see the change soon made in the manners of our inhabitants. From being thoughtless or indifferent about religion, it seemed as if all the world were growing religious, so that one could not walk through the town in the evening without hearing psalms sung in different families of every street. You know, so here's Franklin's testimony about what Whitfield's, the power of Whitfield's influence there, both at the meetings themselves and then also afterwards, as, you know, people are all stirred up and interested in religion there. And Benjamin Franklin was going to have himself a very profound impact on spreading the Great Awakening, because he was going to print Whitfield's sermons, and he was going to send Whitfield's sermons throughout all the colonies and get the word out about Whitfield. And he also printed dozens, literally dozens of books about Whitfield and about Whitfield's ministry in the period from 1740 to 1742, in the height of the excitement of the what's now known as the Great Awakening during that time. Interestingly, however, Franklin himself never had a conversion experience. He says this himself very plainly in his autobiography, that he never converted to Whitfield's religion. He remained fairly deistic in his outlook. So even though he respected and admired Whitfield, and actually he actually defended Whitfield on many occasions when people were trying to deride Whitfield and run him down and impugn his character and talk about how he was trying to collect money for this orphanage, but there was all sorts of rumors that, you know, he was taking this money for himself. And Franklin always defended Whitfield because he knew that his character was sound. He knew that Whitfield was not, you know, doing anything amiss there. And so interestingly, even though he himself didn't share Whitfield's religious convictions, he still continually upheld Whitfield's character and didn't agree with those who were trying to impugn Whitfield. Matter of fact, I think I have a shot here showing you. Well, here's a contemporary woodcut of Whitfield while he's preaching. This is from a sense of, here's Whitfield there preaching to the crowd. And again, he would get up above the crowd where his voice would project out very often so he could preach. Here's one showing you some of the, I told you that some people were impugning his motives. This is a later cartoon about Whitfield from 1763, satirizing him. And so here he is with, you know, the devil, you know, whispering in his ear and, you know, and such. And basically he's a tool of the devil by this particular cartoon here. And under his podium here is a representation of the devil also, who's gathering up the money that's being, you know, given for the purposes of the orphanage and such. And so, you know, here you have the kind of view of his critics, and he did stir up a lot of criticism of people who were uninterested in conversion. In fact, there was a lot of the, especially the Anglican ministers, and by the way, I should say, Whitfield was an Anglican minister himself. Okay, he was ordained in the Anglican Church, he remained in the Anglican Church his entire career. He always tried to reach out to Anglicans, but one of the things actually that Whitfield did that was quite new and different was he tried to reach across denominational lines. And so he tried to reach out to anyone that was willing to allow him to come and preach the about conversion and such. He would go to any pulpit of any of the major churches. He was willing to preach in the Anglican church, but that's usually where he got closed off, especially in the American colonies. The Anglicans generally rejected, especially the pastors, generally rejected his message, and so he very often had to go to other groups, the Presbyterians, the even Baptists. He was willing to preach to the Baptists, and the Baptists were not very highly regarded in a lot of these other church circles either, but he was perfectly willing to preach to the Baptists. He would preach to Quakers, Moravians, whoever wanted him to come preach. He was willing to come and preach and cross those lines, but he did face a good deal of opposition by some of them there. Okay. As Whitfield preached in the colonies in 1740 and then thereafter, by the fall of 1740, he was doing a tour of New England, and he was preaching to about 8,000 people per day at that time. Sometimes he would preach twice, very often he preached twice a day when he'd go into a place. And, you know, people would just, there's this remarkable story of this man in Connecticut that just shows the kind of thing that was happening here. When people, as soon as they knew Whitfield was in town or around, people would just ride out into the countryside and go tell everyone, you know, Whitfield's coming, Whitfield's in there. And people just drop their tools and get on their horses and just rush to the town to try to get there in time to hear Whitfield preach. And this one particular case of a guy named Nathan Cole in Connecticut, he said as he started getting within a couple of miles of town, he saw what he thought was fog rising off what was close to the river. When he got near, he realized that it wasn't fog, it was the dust being pushed by the horses, all the horses and wagons that were going into town to go hear Whitfield, just like he was. And so there's all hundreds and hundreds of people are coming into town to try to hear Whitfield preach there. In October, he was preaching in Boston. And on his farewell address to Boston, he drew a crowd of 23,000 people, which was the largest crowd ever drawn to any event in the American colonies. The population of Boston at that time was 17,000 people. You know, so again, more than the population of the city he was preaching in, he was drawing to preach to the people there. After Boston, Whitfield went to Northampton, where Edwards was. And so he got to meet Jonathan Edwards, and they and Whitfield preached then at Jonathan Edwards' pulpit. And Whitfield reported in his own journal, quote, "Good Mr. Edwards wept during the whole time of exercise. The people were equally affected. And in the afternoon," that was in the morning, he's talking here about the Sunday morning sermon that he gave. And he says, "In the afternoon, the power increased yet more." And if you read Edwards' account of Whitfield coming to his church, he pretty much corroborates this and says that just about everyone was crying, weeping in the meeting. You know, just had a profound impact on the people. And one of the things that took place here was that after 1734 to 35, the revival in Northampton had ebbed, and Edwards was kept trying to get it going and to refan the flame, but hadn't really been too successful in the 5 years or so that had taken place since then. But when Whitfield came, it reanimated the congregation, and everyone became excited about the things of God again, and it was going to continue on to 1740 on for the next several years, that there was going to be this incredible outpouring of religious intensity and excitement after Whitfield came and stirred things up again then. So it was really a powerful, touched off a new wave of revival there. And again, Whitfield this time, though, is going to be stirring up revival not just in one place or a few locations like Edwards' revival. Edwards' revival had been fairly circumscribed. I mean, okay, it had stirred up some neighboring towns, and there are some people in Boston and in London who had read about it, and so that it did stir up some interest in everything. But Whitfield was going to be going from town to town, from area to area, region to region, and he was going to be stirring up revival everywhere he went. And so this is going to make it an incredibly powerful experience in the American colonies and really transform the whole character of the American colonies there in the early 1740s. Whitfield, over the course of his ministry, was going to visit the American colonies 7 times. He kept going back and forth, shuttling back and forth to England and then back to the American colonies. So he came 7 times to the American colonies. His last tour was in 1769 to 1770. And in these later tours, he still was drawing huge crowds, in fact, sometimes even larger crowds than he'd drawn earlier. Interestingly, there don't seem to have been as many conversions taking place during his later preaching tours, probably in part because a lot of the people were already converted who were coming out to see him in the earlier ones. In the 1740s, so many people were converted that, you know, by the late 1740s, there weren't as large a numbers there that were needing conversion at that point. But there was a very interesting episode that took place during this that still shows the incredible power that God was manifesting in his preaching. A man named John Morant, when he came to Charleston, South Carolina, decided he was going to try to disrupt. He and his friend were going to come to Whitfield's meeting, and they were going to disrupt the meeting. And so he brought his French horn with him. And he thought, as soon as Whitfield gets preaching, I'm just going to blast my horn, you know, and disrupt his meeting. And by the way, Whitfield faced this a lot of times, not so much in the colonies, actually, more so in England. And Wesley also faced pretty similar things in England. There was a lot of places, times when he was preaching in England, when he would have people stir up trouble and such. And Whitfield would just outweigh them, usually. if they were just making a bunch of noise, he always finished his sermon. He would just wait until they got tired and left or whatever he had to do, you know, to keep going on his sermon, but from what I've heard, he always finished the sermon. He never let the troublemakers, you know, stop him from doing that. Of course, sometimes other people in the congregation would try to, you know, get the people out or whatever if they could or whatever. But in any case, this particular meeting, this guy was going to go there trying to disrupt their meeting. And Whitfield got up and began his sermon with his text. And according to this person who was John Morant, according to John Morant, Whitfield pointed directly at him and said the text of his sermon, which was, "Prepare to meet thy God, O Israel." And he's pointing right at this guy. He went unconscious for half an hour when that happened. This guy just got knocked out, you know, when Whitfield said that. And the way that, let me read you what one of the, a biographer of Whitfield wrote. He said, "The word came with such ferocious power that it knocked Morant down, and he lay speechless and senseless for half an hour." They were using smelling salts to try to bring him to, you know, at the meeting there. Morant was converted and became an evangelical preacher himself and began reaching out. Actually, this guy was an African-American, he was not a slave, he was a freed African-American. He began preaching the gospel himself throughout that. Whitfield also preached to the African-Americans as much as he could too. Many of the slaves, he tried to preach to them as much as he could in different places. He was very solicitous of their spiritual welfare and tried to focus attention on them in many places that he visited and was very good about reaching out to them. In any case, despite the power behind his sermons, by 1770 he was becoming very ill from all his traveling and the intensity of his preaching circuits and such. And in 1770 he died on his preaching tour of New England. But by that time, he was the most famous man in all the American colonies. And again, he'd crisscrossed the American colonies and preached up and down. Now, by the 1750s or so, the revival had waned somewhat, even though, again, Whitfield was continuing on and still doing some of his preaching tours. There still were people getting converted, but nothing like it had gone on in the early 1740s when there had been such incredibly profound effects. But even though these conversions, the numbers of conversions seem to have diminished over time, Edwards and others claimed, and the evidence seems to suggest, that those who did get converted during these revivals, that stuck, that those people generally did remain faithful to the Lord and did continue to walk with Christ. There were also some profound effects in some of the various denominations at the time. Some were going to grow at the expense of others. The Anglicans diminished in their influence, in part because they didn't embrace the revivals. And so they were having fewer people of converts, fewer people going into the ministry, and other things like that. So other denominations, though, that were stressing the revival, were going to grow at their expense. The Baptists, for instance, were going to grow pretty considerably in this period. From 1740 to 1780, for example, they grew from 96 congregations to 457 congregations during that time. So the Baptists were stressing a conversion. The Presbyterians, and there were others also that were stressing conversion experiences during this time, who also grew pretty remarkably during this time as well. But this was really a powerful experience then for all of the colonies. And in fact, many have argued that it was sort of a formative experience in our nation in many respects, not only for the religious underpinnings of the nation. And even though Franklin and there were other people, obviously not everyone got converted, you know, Franklin and others didn't convert. There were other people who still remained deistic. It probably made that impact much smaller than it would have been otherwise if it hadn't been for the Great Awakening taking place during this time. And it also then laid the groundwork for the freedom of religion that we have in our nation as well. I mean, it's interesting you think about the way that Whitfield was going across denominational lines, which was not a common thing. Denominations were pretty solidified in many cases at that time, certainly in other parts of the world. There was not a lot of give and take between them, but there's going to be much more so in the American colonies. There's going to be much greater amount of freedom there. And like Gilbert Tennent telling people even they could go to different congregations outside their town or parish. I mean, again, that was kind of unheard of thing, especially in other parts of Europe and the world. So he really this revival was going to set up a lot of the character of our religious life, but even of our political and economic and social life too in the 18th century that was going to feed into the origins of the United States ultimately.